From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Talks continue today between Congress and the White House on another coronavirus relief package, and the urgency is growing. We got news today that another 837,000 people filed for unemployment last week, slightly down from the week before, and the fifth consecutive week that claims have stayed below 1 million.
But there may soon be more. The March CARES Act provision prohibiting layoffs expired at midnight, striking a blow to airline workers. And U.S. airlines began laying off and furloughing tens of thousands of employees, including 32,000 involuntary furloughs at United and American Airlines combined. Sarah Nelson joins us now by Skype. She is international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, a union representing some 50,000 workers. And Sarah, tens of thousands furloughed. Your reaction?
We've been telling Congress for months that this would happen, but now we're here. The problem is that this is just today. There's no backstop now because these requirements of the airlines for no layoffs are gone. And so as we continue with only 15% of the revenue from a year ago, this is all due to coronavirus and the impact of that. There are likely other layoffs coming. And we are just the tip of the spear because for every aviation job, we support 1 in 14 jobs in this country. So this is going to start a real tsunami of job loss. And it's devastating.
Talk about this, because, you know, one of the reasons that the airlines were so supported is that it's understood that when the economy gets going, and some members of Congress thought it would be on October 1st, that it's the airlines that move business people around. It's the airlines that move and fuel the economy. So is that what you're saying?
Airlines are the backbone of the economy, and the economy just doesn't work without the airlines. People are counting on the service that the airlines provide to their communities, whether they are an airline passenger or not. The mail gets delivered in the belly of our aircraft, bringing vital medicines and goods and services to these communities. It keeps people connected. We're talking about cuts to communities where people will have to drive 8 and 10 hours just to get to air service or to get to another place. We're talking about all of that infrastructure crumbling now without this deal to continue the payroll support program to get the airlines to do something that they can't really cover right now because their revenues just won't do it. They're making business decisions to cut back to preserve that cash because they're continuing to burn that cash like crazy, but they can't do non-economic things that would burn that even further and put them completely out of business.
Well, but Sarah, for people who are saying, well, wait a second, you know, flight volume is still down nearly 70% compared to last year. Why should people keep jobs in a business that isn't functioning? I mean, in restaurants, they haven't kept their jobs. Why should airlines be kept intact through this time when people aren't flying?
So we are certified safety professionals. One thing that Congress recognized back in March was that if you allow for layoffs in the airline industry, once it's time to get started back up again, you have to call those people back. You have to get them through training. You have to get them requalified. You have to get their security clearances back in place. And if we have a good testing regimen, or we have a vaccine, and all the other sectors are ready to open back up, they can simply open their doors and call people back in. In the airline industry, it can take months and years to bring those certified professionals back to work, and you cannot turn an airline on and off from one day to the next. And it's truly just a couple days that we have, because by next week, those certification lapses start. It's just, it becomes extremely difficult to bring the operation back together.
Well, this is what, I mean, you, of course, represent attendance, and so this would be a point you'd make, but you're backed up by independent aviation analysts. One, Bob Mann, I'm reading, says, does the nation want an airline industry ready to drive the economy when vaccines have been widely administered? If so, you have to pay now to keep the industry vital until then. Meantime, what are you hearing from some of your members, just briefly?
Well, this is devastating. You know, oftentimes you meet your significant other at work. And so we have flight attendants who are getting laid off, and their partners or their spouse are getting laid off too. And so you have an entire household suddenly without a paycheck and without health care. And the numbers that we saw in the layoffs for today don't tell the full story, because there's also people who have been forced on a no-pay status but have been able to hang on to their health care for a little while. So this is really devastating, because there's nowhere else for them to go either. After 9/11, when we saw such massive layoffs, we went to other industries. We went to restaurants. We went to retail. We got other degrees and went into other jobs. And now there's no place to go but the unemployment line.
That's Sarah Nelson, International President of the Association of Flight Attendants. Sarah, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
We're checking in on House races across the country in our run-up to the election. It's part of our Here and Now District Profile series, and today we're going to touch down in Oklahoma's 5th Congressional District, where incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Kendra Horn will face Republican State Senator Stephanie Bice in November. Logan Layden is managing editor at State Impact Oklahoma and KGOU. He's in Norman, Oklahoma. Logan, thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And tell me about the 5th District and how it leans politically over the years.
Well, that's an interesting question. Traditionally, it has been a Republican district. That changed in 2018 when the incumbent Republican was knocked out of his seat by Democrat Kendra Horn. This is a district that includes a large chunk of Oklahoma City, but also some of the rural areas that surround it, which are still heavily Republican. But we're seeing that shift in Oklahoma City, like we're seeing across the country, toward those urban centers and the suburbs, trending more blue, more progressive, more toward the Democrats. That was one of the factors in 2018 that allowed Kendra Horn to take the seat. There were some others as well that went into that. Education was a huge issue at the time. Oklahoma has amongst the lowest paid teachers in the country. That was one of her big issues. And so kind of the demographic change, along with this being such a big issue, in addition to 2018 was a sort of a blue wave for the Democrats. All those things sort of came together to switch it.
Well, let's learn more about Congresswoman Horn. Here's a recent ad of hers.
I show up every day and work hard to do what you elected me to do. Make Congress more accountable to Oklahomans. I know the danger of piling on federal debt, so I stood up to my party on the misguided $3 trillion spending bill because it didn't help us address the real needs of our communities.
So there we hear her pitching herself as someone not afraid to buck her party, which you see a lot from Democrats in red states. What is Kendra Horn running on, and what's her record been like over the last 2 years?
The emphasis really is on being bipartisan. A lot of her ads feature Republicans who say they are going to vote for her. So she's really sort of going for that moderate vote or maybe disaffected Republicans. And I believe the strategy is to sort of take as a given the Democratic side, the progressive side that are going to come out and vote for her. Her positions are fairly moderate. She has opposed some of the things that have come out of the Democratic Party. She opposed some of the things that the Republicans have been pushing as well. I know she was against the sort of piecemeal coronavirus relief, $130 some odd million for the Paycheck Protection loans, in favor of a more comprehensive package. And the other side, the Republicans, have tried to sort of paint her as with Pelosi. You'll see Nancy Pelosi predominantly in the ads against Kendra Horn. So she's tried to stake out a middle ground.
Well, let's hear from the other side. Her challenger is Republican State Senator Stephanie Bice. As we said, she was criticized during the primary for voting on a bipartisan package of tax increases, interesting for a Republican, to fund a teacher pay increase in 2018. Let's hear an ad from her.
When Oklahoma's teachers were the lowest paid in the region, I led the fight for a teacher pay raise. More teachers and smaller classes. Remember the walkout? I stood with our teachers because shortchanging them only shortchanges our kids and Oklahoma's future. In Congress, I'll work for you, not Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, there's that Nancy Pelosi reference you were talking about. Tell me more about Stephanie Bice and her platform.
Stephanie Bice, you know, certainly a committed conservative, well-known in that district. She's a state representative here in Oklahoma and represents an area that is within the 5th Congressional District. The fact that she had voted for that teacher pay increase kind of tells you how big of an issue that is here in Oklahoma. And it also, I think, is her trying to sort of make inroads into that issue, which was so big for Kendra Horn's election in 2018. It was really her support of the teacher pay increase, of teachers in general, that helped push her over the top, just barely, over the Republican incumbent.
Well, what do the polls say? Do Republicans have a decent shot at winning that seat back?
I have to say that they do. This has got to be amongst the most vulnerable Democratic seats in the country. It's a, you know, this little island of blue here in this deeply red state of Oklahoma. The public polling I've seen has it a dead heat, with both candidates somewhere around the 48% range, very few undecided voters. There have been some polling that's been put out from the Democratic side that shows a little more comfortable of a lead for the incumbent Democrat Horn. But again, that's coming from the Democratic side. It's really, really close.
Logan Layden is managing editor at State Impact Oklahoma and KGOU in Norman. Thanks very much for taking a look at Oklahoma's 5th Congressional District with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
We know who John Brown is. His body lay a-smoldering in the grave, as the song goes. The white abolitionist so determined to start a slave uprising that would free the slaves he loved, he led his motley crew into a disastrous battle at Harper's Ferry, after which he was executed and the Civil War was launched. He was a saint. But what if he was also as crazy as a loon? This Sunday, Showtime premieres The Good Lord Bird, an adaptation of James McBride's National Book Award-winning novel, a satirical take on Brown, which tells the twisted tale, as the LA Times calls it, of his crusade. Ethan Hawke plays him as a man who sees himself sent by God.
We are to light the fuse that will start a great war to end slavery. It will be a war between the North and the South. Both are guilty. Both must share the suffering and the sacrifice. Slavery will go down in a tide of blood and carnage.
John Brown takes in a young escaped slave, Little Onion, played by Joshua Caleb Johnson. Brown thinks he's a girl, so Little Onion, used to going along to get along, wears a dress. There's more than a little lunacy here, including a reminder that this country completely lost its mind in the Civil War era. Pro- and anti-slavery militias wander this beautiful landscape, sometimes neighbors blowing each other to bits with a kind of, "Aw, now why'd you have to do that?" attitude, sometimes with breathtaking brutality. Ethan Hawke and James McBride are executive producers. And James, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the kind words.
And we also want to welcome 15-year-old Joshua Caleb Johnson, who plays Little Onion. Joshua, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And James, there's a card at the beginning that says, "All of this is true. Most of it happened." What is true about Brown? Was he kind of crazy, or?
John Brown was your typical New Englander who made up his mind about something and he just went and did it. He was a Calvinist and he was deeply religious, and he was a little bit, he seemed a little bit off his rocker. But at that time, anyone who called a black person anything else other than the N-word was considered, you know, not respected that much. I mean, he was a guy who saw black people as human beings. And he saw slavery as a crime against God. He was a fervent religious person. But you could say that about some of the evangelicals right now who wield guns and run around with AK-47 shooting in the name of God.
Yes.
So the winners write the history. And John Brown, because he loved African-American life and because he wanted people to be free and because he acted against slavery instead of preaching against it, has historically been seen as a kind of crazy man. And I had a lot of fun with it, creating a caricature of the man. And we do a lot of that in the miniseries because it's just so funny, you know, because he was such a funny person.
Joshua, Little Onion, your character, says at one point, "Brown is nuttier than a squirrel turd."
Onion is a narrator of the project, which means you're seeing through the eyes of Onion. And a lot of times, you know, through the eyes of a 12-year-old, it might be a little exaggerated. And, you know, kind of more than what it seems. And so, yes, in Onion's shoes, it was easy to respond to John Brown yelling and being very passionate about freeing the slaves and doing all his speechifying about God and the things he was passionate about.
Yeah. Let's listen to another scene. Again, Ethan Hawke is John Brown and you, Joshua Caleb Johnson, as Onion. You're in the middle of a pitched gun battle, but he, in a very paternal way, is more concerned with what he thinks is you, a young girl's drinking and possibly other sins.
Owen says you're drunk, that you've been swearing and using tobacco. Is that true? Is it true?
Cabin, it's true. I fell in love and got my heart broke.
Did you co-mingle with anyone in a fleshly way without being married?
No, sir.
You didn't?
No, sir.
You promised?
I am still as clean and pure as the day I was born in that fact.
Your soul is more precious than your life. You know that, right? You know that.
And James, we do see the tenderness there, even in the middle of gunfire. But, you mentioned some things that happened today. You know, people taking up arms and going to rallies and this division today. Just your thoughts on the two sides, the pro-slavery, anti-slavery, sometimes neighbors, and just the kind of the viciousness of that time that you got across.
Well, you know, I wrote this book in this, and you know, before all of this happened. But I think most African Americans are familiar with the underlying violence of American society. It's always been there. It's been there all my life. So we're just seeing what most African Americans know has existed in our entire lives. This is not new to us. What's new is that the unveiling of it to other Americans horrifies many people. Well, you know, the only thing I can say is welcome to my world. And that's the world that John Brown saw. You know, he saw that clearly and he tried to change it.
Why did you want us to see it through a young boy's eyes?
Because the innocence of a young boy who's becoming a man is effective. It's an effective storytelling tool. And the fact is, I just didn't feel confident enough to write about it from the perspective of an African-American girl growing up in 1855. That's the main reason. And also because when Onion is telling this story, he's telling it in he's looking back on that period. And his evolution is really beyond the question of race. You know, he loves John Brown. He's not fighting for slavery at all, against slavery at all. He just wants to live, which is how most black people feel. You know, we don't want to get up fighting. We just want to go. We're worried about our wife sleeping with the gardener. I mean, you know, so this kid is just trying to, you know, he's just trying to survive. And he, as he starts to survive and learn, he realizes that in order to be, you know, in order to find God, which is part of it, he needs to just be himself. And it's interesting because Josh was really a boy when he took this role. He actually became a man during the filming of them. He grew a foot during the filming of this miniseries. His voice is even different now.
Joshua, what's it like for you to be in this, be so conscious of that time of division and be watching what's happening now?
For me, it's an amazing feeling to be part of a project that can spark a conversation. Because John, if you think about it, John Brown started this, like this battle that we're still fighting for over 150 years ago, which was, you know, the emancipation and the freedom of all black Americans. And, you know, even present day, we're still fighting that same fight. And me personally, I protest, you know, over social media. I'm always reposting articles. Me and my mom always watch the news together to, you know, make sure we're on topic. But this project, I think, has great capabilities of being able to really start a conversation in America and get people talking.
Yeah. We should say the good Lord bird, James, is actually a now extinct woodpecker. And let's just say maybe goes a little down that road in the show. I got genuinely sad. But metaphor alert here, I mean, the role of the bird.
Well, that's an excellent question. I've never thought of it before. It wasn't meant to be that way. You know, when you write and when things are right in fiction, everything connects. And it was just one of those things that connected. I needed some sort of physical symbol, the quote-unquote good guys or, you know, the home team could see on each other so they would recognize each other when they get separated. It is an interesting metaphor. I never thought of it that way. But I like to think that John Brown's death and what he did at Harper's Ferry, as satirical as this miniseries is and as fun it is to watch, I hope that all the blood that has been shed is done. Mm.
I asked you about, you know, seeing this through a young man's eyes, and you spoke mm-hmm. eloquently to that. But in the production notes, you and Ethan Hawke, I believe, say, Onion is us. He's America.
Absolutely. Josh really represents the new generation of Americans for whom we have given so little. And, you know, I'm so proud of Joshua. And when I say that, not just as an actor, but as a young man, because he represents these young people now who have different views on race than we ever did. Many of them do not carry the mental baggage that we carry. And I never thought I'd live long enough to see that. I think that's been the greatest thing that this miniseries has done for me, opened my eyes and heart to what some of these young people now are capable of.
And Joshua, just one last thought with you. Well, that's not a heavy lift or anything. You are symbolizing America, all of America in the film. Did you feel a certain importance or weight? I mean, yes, there's some that's just some things are so ridiculous and funny. But, you know, being in the middle of this time, did you find yourself thinking about what your life might have been like in that time or, you know, feeling that weight?
I generally feel that my life would have been somewhat close to Onion's because of the fact that, you know, Onion is what they call on the show a mulatto. And me being lighter skinned, I'm kind of in the middle of, oh, I'm not black enough, or, yeah, I'm not white enough. And that's kind of what Onion has to, you know, go through, because mm-hmm. throughout the show, Onion doesn't really have anywhere to belong. Like, he never really feels at home until towards the end of the show. And mm-hmm. if you're talking about how if Onion symbolizes America, and like, you know, James said about this is kind of my generation's time to talk about our racial point of views and talk about what we think. This show, like I said earlier, it gives us a great opportunity to spark a real conversation about what needs to happen in America and what needs to change in order for us to really achieve peace in America.
That is Joshua Caleb Johnson, the star of the new Showtime limited series, The Good Lord Bird, based on James McBride's novel of the same name. It premieres this Sunday. James McBride is an executive producer. James, Joshua, thank you both so much for speaking with us. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having both of us. Yes.
Royal Dutch Shell is slashing up to 9,000 jobs as the oil giant accelerates a shift to low-carbon energy. And as we've been reporting for months now, the entire industry is faltering as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Oil prices are now at $40 a barrel after falling from record highs last year. Let's take a deeper look with MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Ali, welcome back.
Hey, Peter.
And let's start with those job cuts at Shell, up to 10% of its workforce by 2022, partly to cut costs, but also to shift to lower carbon fuels. Oil companies think long term they'll probably all be shifting that way. Is Shell just putting its foot on the accelerator?
Yeah, probably. It's reported a loss for the second quarter in a row. It's cut its dividend for shareholders for the first time since World War II. Production is down at Shell about 70,000 barrels a day. Some of that's because of the recent hurricanes that we've seen in the Gulf. But they're laying people off. They're going to shrink their refining operations. They're going to focus on high-value oil production. Oil has different production values depending on what you do with it. But basically, the outlook is that the world reached peak oil demand in 2019, and that demand could fall by 50% over the next 20 years. Shell is one of those companies that's committed to becoming carbon neutral by 2050, which is kind of amazing for an oil company. And that's part of it. Some of these oil companies are realizing at the moment oil's not that profitable. They're not going to be selling more of it than they have in the past. So for some companies, not all of them, this looks like a time to start shifting.
And it looks like we're seeing some bankruptcies in the industry too.
Quite a few. And in fact, given how it's going right now, we've seen 150, we could see 150 oil and gas companies go bankrupt in the United States by 2023. Right now, we've had about 30 to 40 bankruptcies in oil and gas just in the last year or so here in the United States.
Well, sometimes it takes a crisis to make a change. Analysts have been saying that the global demand for oil may never return to its 2019 record high. Do you see this pandemic and these environmental, you know, forces right now basically pushing energy companies to realign their business models more quickly than they had expected to?
Yeah, there's two specific issues going on. One is, you said, the price of oil, about $40 a barrel. It's not profitable. You know, oil is not the way it used to be, where you just drill a hole into the ground and it comes out. You can do that for 10 or 15 bucks a barrel. It's probably upward of $50 a barrel to be profitable with shale or oil sands or things like that. So as long as oil remains below 50 bucks a barrel, it just, a lot of these companies, they can't make money off of it. COVID has reduced world oil demand by about 2.5 million barrels a day. And, you know, the new closures and more COVID cases is making people think it might be till next year before we get that back. And remember, it's not just demand for normal things like driving, which is obviously huge. There's very little air travel, and jet fuel demand is a very small part of this. So some of the demand will come back when COVID goes away or when there's a virus, when there's a vaccine. But there is some sense that some of this demand may fundamentally shift into non-fossil fuels or renewable fuels.
And we're also seeing the government step in. We see a report from environmental groups yesterday that say the Fed has purchased about $350 million in debt from oil and gas companies to try to prop them up along with the economy as things sort of sour here before our eyes. That's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Ali, thanks very much for your time, as always. This week, Wisconsin recorded record numbers for new daily hospitalizations and deaths due to the coronavirus. The pandemic continues to surge in that state, and incidentally, it's where President Trump plans to hold two rallies on Saturday. For more, we're joined now by Stephanie Smiley. She's interim state health officer for the state of Wisconsin. Stephanie, we're seeing bright red spots all over the map of Wisconsin. How serious is the outbreak in your state right now?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have good news coming out of Wisconsin. It is a serious situation in terms of the numbers of cases that we're seeing on a daily basis. And certainly our trend for the last week, you know, we're seeing over 2,300 cases on average each day. We are continuing to see increases in staffing shortages in our healthcare system. And increased hospitalizations as well. So, a situation here that we're really concerned about.
Do you have any idea how it got that bad?
It's a combination of factors. We know that schools have been hybrid reopening in some parts of the state. You know, we also have many colleges and universities, who have also opened. And so this isn't unexpected. We did expect to see, increased transmission anytime people are gathering. We can expect to see that. I think, where we were surprised was the how quickly the surge in cases occurred in our state. And so, differing compliance with our mask mandates, folks maybe not taking it as seriously as we would hope to help control the spread. And so, what I will say is that over the past couple of weeks, we have seen, folks in colleges and universities really, taking the steps to ensure that that they are, doing things safely. And so we have seen, decreases in that age group of folks in our state. But we also know that because of the peak that we saw a couple of weeks ago, now we're starting to see other age groups increasing in those case reports as well.
Well, it does sound serious, and we see that the number of people hospitalized in Wisconsin because of the virus reached a new high earlier this week. Some of your hospitals, it looks like, are also reaching capacity. What's the situation inside those buildings?
There's concern, that we are, many hospitals are reporting, critical staffing shortages. Certainly there are patients, needing care for COVID. I think the bigger challenge that systems are facing are really around folks who are, you know, caring for those patients are unable to come in because they're either they've been exposed or are ill themselves. And so it's actually a staffing situation in combination with those increased numbers that I think has us pretty concerned.
Your state health secretary, Andrea Palm, said this week that Wisconsin is considering opening a state-run field hospital to help handle the overflow. Yeah. I mean, the U.S. Army mm-hmm. Corps of Engineers built 30 of these across the country back in April, but yours in Wisconsin yeah. would be the first to actually be used. How close are you to actually opening it?
You know, we continue to monitor the situation. I think area has said, you know, that we are ready to do that now. I think we'll have a better sense of that in the next week or so. It is sort of our last resort. It is not something we want to use. You know, we will continue to monitor this, you know, over the coming weeks, and we certainly hope that we will not have to use it.
Well, I'm sure you've heard the news that President Trump plans to hold two rallies in Wisconsin over the weekend, one in La Crosse mm-hmm. and one in yep. Green Bay. These are hot spots in Wisconsin. In your professional opinion, yeah. is it wise mm-hmm. to attend these rallies?
So as a public health professional, we are urging everyone not to attend large gatherings. You know, COVID-19 is spreading widely in Wisconsin, and, you know, we want folks to assume that any event that people are attending, that they are at risk for exposure and potentially exposed because of the widespread transmission occurring in Wisconsin.
Do you expect to see a spike in the weeks following these rallies?
That is hard to say. You know, anytime we have gatherings of folks, you know, those things may be cited through our contact tracing efforts as potential exposures. But, you know, we investigate large gatherings every week and every day. And so, you know, certainly the potential is there. And that is why we are urging people to not attend large gatherings.
Stephanie Smiley is the interim state health officer for the state of Wisconsin. Stephanie, looks like you have a big job ahead of you. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Well, as the coronavirus pandemic rages on, hospitals and pharmacies have also been stocking up on vaccines against influenza. The flu can strain the healthcare system in normal times, so health experts have been sounding the alarm about what it could mean this year. One of those experts is Dr. Kevin Ban, Chief Medical Officer for Walgreens, the nation's second largest pharmacy. Dr. Ban, welcome. And how much has Walgreens increased its stockpile of the flu vaccine this year?
Well, we knew that there would be increased demand coming into the flu season, given that we're in the COVID pandemic. And, you know, it's early days right now, but we expect that demand could increase by as much as 30 to even 50%.
I was thinking just the opposite. You know, maybe some people thinking they would skip the flu vaccine this year because they just don't want to go to a pharmacy or a doctor's office while there is a pandemic going on.
Well, you know, what we're trying to do, because it's fundamentally important that people get vaccinated for flu this year, you know, in the context of the pandemic, what I mean by that is we want to make sure that we take pressure off the healthcare system. We know that millions of people get the flu annually. Hundreds of thousands of people end up admitted to the hospital, and tens of thousands of people lose their lives. We know that with vaccination, we can decrease all of those numbers, and we want to make sure that we lean into all of the public health measures that we have to keep people safe.
Yeah, so if people are thinking, well, you know, I'm mostly staying inside, I'm not going out much, I don't need a flu shot, you say what?
I understand the concern that people may be reluctant to go out and get their flu shot. What we've done at Walgreens is we're making sure that the pharmacist wears not only a mask, but a face shield when they're administering the vaccine. And then what we're doing is we're taking the temperature of patients and screening them for symptoms. Now, the patient is also expected to wear a mask. If they don't have one, we'll provide the mask. And then lastly, we are following very strict cleaning protocols to make sure that the site is safe for vaccination.
And doctor, what are you doing to get that flu vaccine out into the community so that more people are vaccinated?
Yeah, one of the strengths of Walgreens is that we're embedded in 9,200 communities across the country. So, for example, we are partnering with local community groups, whether they be churches or not-for-profits or even employers, to make sure that we provide off-site clinics. It gives us an opportunity to not only vaccinate people, but also to educate them. As it turns out, in 2018-2019, only slightly more than one-third of African Americans and Hispanics got the flu vaccination. And this year, we're trying to do everything that we can to reach out to those communities and to encourage vaccination.
But are you concerned that, people just won't want to get the flu shot in this environment that we're in?
There has always been a certain amount of vaccination hesitancy. And the role that we can play, since we're embedded in community, is really to educate people around the facts around vaccination. And then at the same time, debunk myths. What we really want to do is we want to motivate people who may be uncertain, and we really want to encourage them to get vaccinated this year.
Well, I have you. I mean, as you well know, the world is waiting for a coronavirus vaccine. What is Walgreens doing to get ready for that, to make sure that you have enough of it when it's available and that you can safely distribute it to those who need it?
It's important that we arrive at a safe vaccine. And of course, that's all focused on the development and then manufacturing of the vaccine. Equally important is that we pay attention to the distribution of that vaccine. So we're working very closely with our state and federal partners and with manufacturers to make sure that we're ready to distribute the vaccine when it's ready.
Dr. Kevin Band, Chief Medical Officer for Walgreens, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
October is here, rabbit, rabbit. Colder weather is coming in much of the country. There's a pandemic, a really bile-inducing debate, wildfires in the West. Oh, if we only had some noodle soup. Oh, resident chef Kathy Gunster's here, socially distanced, but she has some suggestions. And, you know, first of all, Kathy, does everybody say rabbit, rabbit on the first day of the month, or did I just sound insane?
No, I do that, if I remember. Oh, good. Of course, I forgot this morning.
Okay, so rabbit, rabbit.
Boy, you listed all the reasons we need some comforting, nourishing noodle soup right now. And
right.
These soups are eaten all over the world. Think of Thai red curry noodle soup, Japanese ramen, Vietnamese pho, Taiwanese beef noodle soups, Jewish chicken noodle soup.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's plenty. And you know, sometimes, though, people don't want to make soups because they get blocked by thinking they have to make their own soup stock. So start just weigh in there.
Sure. Stock is the base of all soups. And the truth is, whether you want to hear it or not, that the better your stock, the better your soup, which is not to say that you cannot use a well-respected, reliable, low-sodium box stock. There are several really good brands now. You just want to be careful of the amount of salt you use when you use boxed or canned stock. But the truth is that making homemade stock is quite simple, particularly in these days when we're all home.
Yeah, so you just throw a lot of vegetables that are just about to go anyway in. I'm talking about vegetable stock, and let it simmer. I mean, just is that the basics?
Yeah. Essentially, you can use peelings and scrappings and chicken soup. You just throw a chicken in a pot with some vegetables. It's really a matter of throwing a few things in, letting it simmer, and bingo, you get stock.
If nothing else, the house smells great. Okay, let's start with Thai red curry.
Yeah, so this is a soup that borrows flavors from several classic Thai soups. It uses red curry paste, fresh ginger, cilantro, and coconut milk. It is not super spicy, but it has this warm, delicious, really a soup with a lot of depth. And then you boil udon noodles separately, throw them into the soup with some fresh spinach and slivered snow peas, and you serve it with all these beautiful garnishes like grated carrots and bean sprouts, cilantro, and chili paste. This is a main course meal, and it's so colorful. It will brighten the most dismal of days.
There you go. And by the way, you say cook noodles separately because, for in every dish, because?
Well, noodles like to drink. When you add noodles directly to a soup, they will drink up all your beautiful stock and flavorings and turn it to a thick mush. So you always want to cook your noodles in a separate pot of boiling salted water. And then you slightly undercook them. Then you can add them to your soup and they won't change the texture and drink up all the work you've done.
They have a drinking problem. Okay, the next...
And they do.
I shouldn't joke about that. No, no jokes. We're not joking about that. The next soup you want to share with us is tortellini and brodo with spinach and Parmesan. Brodo.
Brodo is the Italian word for stock or broth. This is a combination of an Italian soup that uses tortellini, those beautiful they look like monk's caps, actually.
Yeah.
Stuffed pasta with fresh spinach and grated Parmesan. It also mixes in some of the flavors of stracciatelle, another fabulous Italian soup. And you use chicken broth or vegetable broth. These soups are very adaptable for vegetarians. You can use pre-made tortellini. You basically cook them separately, throw them into the hot stock, parsley, pepper, and then you grate fresh Parmesan cheese over it. This is really a 10-minute soup if you have your stock ready, and really comforting.
Okay. It's just, there's very tempting. We'll have everything at hereandnow.org. We always, you know, break the internet, so the recipes will be there. And let's go on to the classic chicken noodle soup. It is supposed to have restorative powers.
Yes. Growing up, we called it Jewish penicillin because whenever someone had a cold coming, it was time to make chicken noodle soup. And again, this really, really begs for a homemade chicken stock. But you can make this with a grocery store roasted chicken and box stock. You add onions and carrots and celery and rich, chewy egg noodles. And this is the classic. This is what I turn to on days when nothing feels right, or I just have that sort of tickle in the back of my throat.
Yeah, okay. Just one more quick noodle soup suggestion.
Oh, a quick miso ramen with chicken and bok choy, a real favorite. And then we also have a link to a Greek soup, avgo limono, with orzo, the rice-shaped pasta. Quick soups really will warm you up as it starts to get colder out and will warm your heart.
Well, you know, and make your own. Some of those little boxes of those kinds of soups, you might as well just open your salt shaker and eat it. Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst will have everything at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks.
Thanks, Robin. Stay well.
Yeah, you too. And Peter, we just want to take a moment here to wish a happy birthday to former President Jimmy Carter. 96 today. He's lived longer than any president in American history. In my mind's eye, he will always be nailing a plank in a Habitat for Humanity house somewhere.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
Indeed. Happy birthday, Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. COVID cases on the rise, a chaotic presidential debate, and the failure of Congress to pass a relief package. We'll discuss in our weekly roundtable. That's next time on Here and Now.